Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope you all have enjoyed our daily market commentary on our website, podcast, and YouTube channel throughout the week, covering everything from the market moves and what happened post-Fed meeting. On this weekend show, we're going to be spending the first half of the show looking more broadly at the market, some of the economic data, and diving into the bond market and commodities. In the back half of the show, we're going to spend our time in the energy sector, oil and natural gas, and some of the opportunities within that sector and that area. To kick off the show, we are chatting with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report, which you can find on Substack, which I will link to in the show notes. Now, Peter, let's talk about the market here. The markets continue to, in a way, grind higher. They've lost some of that upward momentum, but that being said, S&P and NASDAQ recently did hit some all-time highs. The Dow has broadly lagged, and the small caps, the Russell, is still, well, way behind a lot of these markets. But again, there doesn't seem to be a ton of fear in the markets. But that being said, there, again, that momentum has been lost to the upside. What have you noticed in terms of market internals, Peter?
It's been very much an either-or market. It's either NVIDIA and Apple and Google and Microsoft and anything touching AI, or it's everything else. Because when those stocks rally, seemingly other things sell off. And when those stocks sell off, everything else rallies. I think in the aggregate, those big names continue to drive the headline indices to well outperform everything else. If you even take the S&P market weight return, you're talking low double digits. If you look at the equal weight return, it's under 4%. You see the Russell 2000 also lagging dramatically here over the past, call it month plus. And I always find these divergences interesting, because if those big cap names are going to have sustainable success selling AI products, they need the rest of the stock market, the companies outside of those big names, to buy those products. So to be selling the buyers of those products at the same time you're buying the producers of them, I find quite interesting. And just the market cap increases are just astonishing. I read some stat somebody had on Twitter that over a 30 plus day time frame, NVIDIA added $1 trillion of market cap. And over a 60 year time frame, Berkshire Hathaway is only nearing $1 trillion. So a lot of this is certainly multiple expansion momentum, because the market wants to pay up for where they can find growth relative to more sluggish parts of the market. But the market cap increases are just eye-popping.
Yeah, Peter, you said it. It's really been stunning to watch the rise of NVIDIA and just how quickly it's added in trillions to market cap, what has taken, like you say, other companies like Berkshire Hathaway decades to do the same thing. And there is a big focus on AI right now from investors. But you had made a point to us off mic and also in your Substack articles that when you sit in on a lot of company conference calls and earnings reports and just their guidance, AI comes up in the discussion. And just because it's a hot topic for investors doesn't mean it's really helping the bottom line of a lot of companies. I'd love you to expand on that point.
Because mostly it's been all on the capital spending side when it comes to developing these AI models. NVIDIA is obviously reaping the real benefits of it, but that's via the build out of these, of the infrastructure to create these models. The actual purchasing of AI, whether it's Copilot for Microsoft or signing up for ChatGPT from OpenAI, it's much smaller relative to that spend. I do think, though, the last quarter, investors are beginning to ask the question of, okay, you guys are spending boatloads of money to build this out, but where is the return on investment going to be? And I think the other thing we realized after hearing from earnings from a bunch of software companies like Workday and Salesforce and CrowdStrike and so on, that the capital spending pie is not growing. It's just companies just reallocating their spend away from one part of their IT spend to another, which I find somewhat interesting. And then you also have a slew of companies that are yet to aggressively spend until they see how this plays out. Because what we're seeing is Meta has its own AI platform that they're developing that's going to be open source, basically handing it out for free. Microsoft obviously has ChatGPT and Google has Gemini and we have some others. And are these all going to be somewhat commoditized products that we're all going to have access to and it ends up being just more of a tool rather than anything else? It costs those companies huge amounts of money to develop, but we get the benefit from all that spend with the, again, a return on investment calculation be very much uncertain.
So, Peter, from a big picture standpoint here, does AI, in your eyes, have a chance to change the world in the business sense, potentially in the way of lowering labor costs? Labor costs are a key component to a lot of inputs for companies, and in the way that, I guess, technology, computers made companies more efficient and more streamlined, could AI be going down that road?
Well, the first papers on AI were written in the 1950s. So AI in some form has been, and software and technology has been transforming the world since the history of time. So that's going to continue. This is just another sort of iteration of AI, this generative form of it. And yeah, it's going to be making life easier in terms of certain tasks, no doubt about it. But luckily, that's what technology, generally speaking, does. Just that we're able to, I can have this conversation with you over the phone and it can be transformed onto a podcast reaching thousands and thousands of people. You know, for years, when you call the cable company or the phone company, you're talking to a computer first. That's been going on for a long time. So, I mean, Google itself is, when it was created, search was a form of AI where it grabbed everything out there that it could find to help you and refine your search. So it maybe this is many leaps forward, but yeah, but that's what technology does, and that's the beauty of it.
Well, it's really created a bifurcated market, as you mentioned at the onset, where it seems like there's the haves and the have-nots, with so many investors piled into such a very narrow bandwidth of mega-cap tech leadership. Do you see any opportunities in the small caps or in the rest of the S&P 497, the 493 that are not included in those top seven? Do you think that we'll see the market breadth improve and more investors take some gains in the space and filter it into other areas of the market?
So you basically asked the most important question, because yes, firstly, there are a tremendous amount of opportunities that I find out there outside of those names. There are many value stocks that we own, many stocks even in the commodity space that even after having a rally still remain very attractive. And to your second point, the question is the market going to broaden out, or are these stocks going to catch up? Will at some point value close that performance gap with growth? Or my fear is, on the other hand, what if these big stocks crap out? What happens if NVIDIA misses earnings next quarter, or in three quarters, or in four quarters, because order rates slow, or inventory is building up and they had to cut prices? What happens if some of these companies disappoint? Because there's no room for error. The valuations that they're trading at, I mean, Apple is back to 31 times earnings. There's no valuation support there. It's running on AI hype. So if those stocks took a breather, do people then rotate into other things? Like I mentioned earlier on the either or market, if you go back to 2000, 2001, we did see that. We did see tech crack, but investors were able to find other things to buy, particularly in the value space. Now, unfortunately, the latter part of 2001 into 2002, everything collapsed and gave it up. But there was a period of value stock outperformance. I'm hoping that repeats itself, because like I said, there are many opportunities out there in the value space. But it's clear that investors believe that the only place that they're going to find attractive growth is in these big tech stocks, or certain parts of the semiconductor space, for example. But you know, there are plenty of other companies that use technology that are customers of these companies that are going to benefit from these technological advancements, particularly AI.
What about the shift to more defensive assets or investments, like moving more into the bond market? We do generally have higher rates. However, they are off of some of their highs from late last year and even just a couple months ago. But as much as people, I guess, can get 5% on a safe money market investment, they're still chasing the markets. Does that change?
That's very interesting point, because yes, that risk-free rate is much higher than it's been. And your hurdle rate is 5%-ish. And obviously, based on certain stocks in the market, they're very comfortable and confident that they can clear that. But for the rest of the market, I mean, people are thinking, why am I going to take risk in the small cap stocks, particularly one that is more sensitive to changes in interest rates? I mean, there is a fundamental factor here going on, and that a lot of certain set of companies, smaller companies, are more sensitive to the inflation that we've seen and wage costs that are higher and the cost of capital that's higher. And that has impacted business decisions and decisions to expand. So there is a fundamental factor creating this underperformance in small mid relative to the very big. But you just wonder how sustainable that is.
Well, when you think about interest rates, Peter, and you think about how the bond market auctions have been going, they haven't really been going that hot. They've been kind of weak, depending on which one you were looking at. But for a while, you just made a note in your morning missive that the 10-year actually was pretty well bid this time. And I wonder, does this play in at all to what the Fed is doing with their quantitative tightening, where they're kind of throttling it back, just like they tapered their bond buying a couple of years ago? Now they're tapering down the reduction of their balance sheet. I think they were at $90 billion a month and they were at $60 billion. Now they're down to $25 billion. At one point, that will end, which means they'll actually be buyers in the market again. Could that be part of it? Or what's your take on the bond market and how the Fed's QT plays into that?
Well, the QT was reduced from 90 to 55 because it was really, the mortgage part did not change. The treasury part went from 60 to 25. So, but yes, that easily could have been a factor. Like one thing that I touched upon is you wish you can survey the buyers for why they did what they did. What was the motive of the aggressive buying, particularly the day before a Fed meeting, particularly the day before an important inflation number? Is what were you thinking? Was it because the Fed now is not really essentially selling as much as they were? Are you worried about economic growth? Are you worried about the continued rise in the unemployment rate? Are you seeing that other central banks are cutting interest rates and maybe you think the Fed is going to follow? You wonder whether all of these were a factor. Now, we have this, of course, comes after the 3-year, which was not good, and maybe the 30-year will not be good either, and this 10-year could have been an outlier, but you wonder why we saw such aggressive buying. And to quantify, the bid-to-cover ratio for this Treasury auction was the best since February 2022. So there definitely was an underlying bid there. And you always have to wonder why, particularly when yields continue to fall in response to that.
Where do you see a sweet spot for yields? We've heard of this higher for longer narrative, which it seems like the market's even starting to come around to. But interest rates, look, again, they're off of their highs, but they're off of their lows from late last year. Is this going to be more of a stable rate environment in your eyes, more of a sideways move?
It could be for a period of time, but that's the thing about higher for longer is sideways still is in a way a continuous form of tightening, because every day there's some loan that's maturing. And you can only imagine all those companies, all those real estate people that have just been praying for lower interest rates. All interest rates need to do is stay where they are, and there's continued pain for anybody that has debt coming due. That maturity wall is still out there, whether it's in corporates or commercial real estate or wherever, or even somebody's adjustable rate mortgage in the U.S. or anywhere in Canada, in Australia, in the U.K., anybody who has a mortgage that is resetting to this, that was priced before this jump in interest rates, they're getting impacted. So the pain can still occur with interest rates just staying where they are. Now, on the flip side, there are people that are benefiting from higher interest rates. Those that have saved money, those that are benefiting from 5% interest income, they're loving this. Baby boomers are loving this because after 15 years in the desert searching for a positive interest rating on their savings, they finally have it. So there's certainly pluses and minuses that we've seen from a higher interest rate environment, just as they were when rates were at zero. When rates were at zero, the borrowers loved it. The savers hated it.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, Peter, because for the first time ever, savers can finally get some yield. But like you mentioned earlier, the small businesses and people in real estate are dreading, and even in commercial real estate, are dreading those loans as they roll over, as are a lot of municipalities and governments as their loans roll over. So it's going to be interesting to see how this higher for longer, or even just stable for longer, plays out as more loans roll over. Another sector that's definitely affected by interest rates and by the moves in currencies also comes down to the commodities. And we've seen the commodities in general getting a nice bid the last couple months. From February to May, we saw everything from gold and silver and copper to nat gas and aluminum and zinc and nickel all clawing their way back higher again. Over the last couple weeks, though, the commodities have generally rolled over. Do you read into this anything as far as the economy? Is this due to the Fed cutting cycle, or is there something abroad on the global picture changing up the dynamics here for the commodities sector?
I think it's more of a rest. I think certainly one thing that has been driving the higher commodity prices have been worries about supply. I mean, you look at cocoa, that was clearly a supply-driven price spike. You look at coffee, it was a supply-driven price spike. You look at copper, I can argue the same thing. There's definite demand drivers out there, but it wasn't like they came out of nowhere to result in that spike. But yes, oil prices have fallen, but natural gas prices are quietly at the highest level of the year, just over the past couple of days, just as we get into the summer season and people are turning on their air conditioners. So I think in the aggregate, there's been a nice run in commodity prices. And to me, they're more just taking a breather. You look at the CRB food index, I mentioned a few ag prices, but it's just off the highest level since last October. It wasn't too long, maybe it was just within the last, call it, I'm just looking at a chart, it was just a few weeks ago where the CRB raw industrials index hit a multi-year high. It's since pulled back, but it's still well off its lows. It's still well off its highs, but well off its lows. I think commodities are in a bull market again, and these pullbacks should be used as buying opportunities.
Peter, how much do we need to pay attention to China through all of this? I know that we've touched on it before, but Chinese data and their stockpiling of copper seem to have a role in the copper market. And then the recent news of them, the Chinese central bank, not buying gold through the month of May. How much of an impact? How much do we need to pay attention to China?
Well, they're the elephant in the room when it comes to a lot of these things. They're so big with what they need to buy and what they want to stockpile. So we have no choice but to pay attention. I mean, when you think about how astute China was over the past year and a half to be buying as much gold as they did, while Western investors, via what we've seen with the liquidation in ETFs, they've been big sellers, thinking that the rise in interest rates was going to be negative for owning gold. China's still going to be a major player. Now, you look at copper, they're obviously buying less copper when it comes to the residential real estate development because they're not building as many apartments, but China still needs a boatload of copper to build out their electrical grid. India is now the big buyer when it comes to a lot of these industrial commodities. They're the massive buyer of copper. They're spending $1 trillion in infrastructure over the last couple of years and with plans to spend another trillion. So they're a big player. That's to think about when you think about, I think it's very easy for people when they look at the commodity space to just say, okay, where's U.S. and European growth and what's China going to do? Yeah, okay, that's fine. Those are big economies, but you still have to look at the rest of the industrial world, the rest of the emerging market world. And I mentioned India, but you also have Indonesia. You have South America. You have other parts of Asia. Everyone trying to modernize. Growing middle classes everywhere that want to eat protein instead of rice and beans. They need more protein, where you need more crops as feedstock. You need more wealth to buy more cars, need more metals. I mean, I think there's an underappreciation. And yes, China is a major player that they will continue to be. We also have to expand what we look at when looking at the demand drivers for these things.
Well, Peter, just tugging on that string, when you think about the demand drivers, in addition to the whole developing world needing electrification and needing more proteins and needing more vehicles and gadgets, just like in the West, there's also the whole narrative that AI has now infected the commodity sector when you think about the power generation that's going to be needed. They keep talking about these AI data centers, not to mention all the EV stations that need to be built and the crypto mining. So the demands on the power grids are going to be huge in every country. And that is doing things like spiking copper, as far as the wiring and transmission of electricity. Nat gas has got a boost, and they're covering that. Silver's got a boost because they're mentioning all the solar panels and solar farms that'll be needed. Uranium and nuclear power back on the menu. Do you think that the energy story is another thing that's possibly responsible for some of the recent rise in the commodities that relate to energy?
There's no question, because when you rewind the clock a year before we were talking about AI, really the current version of it, I guess we started talking about AI in late 2022. So rewind before that, none of these conversations were taking place. And all the things that you mentioned are long lead time type investments. The incoming CEO of Freeport-McMoRan, the big copper producer, was on CNBC saying that in a developing a new mine, you're talking about 7 to 15 years of finding it, developing it, bringing it to production. This newfound demand for everything that you mentioned, particularly power from utilities, this wasn't in anybody's game plan and budgeting just a year and a half ago. So to all of a sudden see the demand side, the supply side, just it's impossible for it to timely catch up. It takes time. It takes many years to prepare for this flood of demand that wasn't anticipated. Hence the rise in all these different things that I think will continue, notwithstanding these pullbacks.
So Peter, circling around just to the broad markets, investor sentiment, mentality, and where some of these markets stand. Again, a number of markets have done very well over the recent past. Have you seen this in history before, where we have central banks that are now possibly starting to slowly cut rates? Again, we are recording this before the Fed meeting, but we saw two rate cuts last week out of the ECB and the Bank of Canada. Markets are up at close to, if not all-time highs. Commodities have gone through a good run. Any times in history we can relate this to?
No, usually central banks are cutting rates because the economy is in a recession and they're all scrambling to save growth. This is definitely unusual. And at least right now, the cutting that we're getting, at least if you listen to ECB members and even Bank of Canada, which is cutting, and we know the Swift cab, they're treating this as more of a tweak rather than the beginning of a progression of cut, because they can't rationalize a progression of cut. Yes, inflation is fluid. They're happy about that. They're cheering that. They think it's going to stay down, which remains to be seen. But I understand they're trying to take the edge off that sharp and dramatic rise in interest rates in a very short period of time. So I think a tweak is okay. I think even if the Fed threw in a tweak this year, that would be okay. But that's a much different scenario than what we've seen in the past, where the first rate cut was opening the floodgates of many in order to save an economy. This time it's much more complicated, and central banks still have to deal with the risk of inflation flaring up again. What happens if we're right on commodities and they continue to head higher, and this pullback in oil reverses and goes back to $80 or $90, and natural gas prices continue to rise, and inflation flares up again? Then what are these central banks going to do? They're certainly not cutting anymore. Now, we'll have to see whether they reverse and hike again. They can potentially be caught flat-footed. I think one of the lessons learned from the 1970s was not only do you want to see a decline in inflation, you want to see a sustainable decline in inflation. Because acting prematurely without seeing the sustainability of it, then you create the situation where it flares back up again. And so it's almost like catching this inflation knife that some of these central banks that are cutting, that's what they're doing, and hoping that they don't get cut. I think that that's right now a dangerous game. Again, I'll give them their tweak. The Fed maybe will give a tweak, take the edge off a little bit. But we're far from going back to the days of zero interest rate.
Yeah, we really do seem to be. Always interesting comments here, Peter. Thank you so much for taking time with us. Again, I recommend everybody checking out Peter's Substack, The Book Report, which a link will be posted in the show notes. Always valuable to have you on the show, Peter, and I really enjoy reading over all the notes you send out to all your subscribers. So keep up the good work. We'll probably chat again sometime next month. Peter, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure chatting.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.